Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 53 of Registry Matters. Well, good evening, Larry. How's it going this week?
Kind of tired, but I'm here. How's it going in FYP East?
Is it just because you're 100 years old that you're tired?
I am not 100. I'm only 94.
Okay, so we're getting there. So is there like 1 foot on a banana peel and one in the grave?
Pretty much, yes.
All right, then. I want to give you credit for being super duper right on something. There's this legal podcast that I listen to called Opening Arguments. And you threw at me. I was like, how is this thing with Jim Acosta, the CNN reporter? How is this a due process thing? It feels to me that the people are there as a privilege of the presidents to do the reporting and so forth. But it turns out that because they like voluntarily set up this whole thing to invite reporters in to exercise, you know, to be that fourth estate and all that. So with that whole thing of removing his credentials, it created two problems. One, a First Amendment thing of them stifling speech. But then there was the Fifth Amendment, the due process side of it, which is what you brought up. And I was like, you're nuts. But no, that's what it has turned out to be. So Larry was right.
Well, I appreciate that. I had just peripherally read about, and I haven't even read the case, but I guess there was a case in the 70s from the Supreme Court that dealt with this issue. And it's like there are things that you don't have a right to, but once they're granted to you as a privilege, the privilege being taken away requires some process. And I guess the best example that people could relate to would be the privilege of driving. That's not a right. It's a privilege. But once the privilege is bestowed up to a person after they pass the visual acuity and the knowledge of the roads and the signs test and all the various testing and proficiency, then they're granted a privilege. Then to take that privilege away requires due process. And I said on the podcast on that episode that the president does not have to allow any access. And it's relatively modern that we've had the formal news conference. Probably the news conferences we know it today developed under President Kennedy. He was so good at the camera and so witty with the press. But prior to that, it was very informal. A few reporters would be invited into the White House to sit down by the president's desk, and they would have informal chats. But once they grant these privileges to cover the White House, then to take the privilege away requires a process. And it has nothing to do with Acosta's employer, which is, I think, one of our podcast listeners confused that issue. And he said that there's no right to a job. He's right. CNN can do what they want to with him. They can say you've disrespected our protocols and how you acted and conducted yourself in the White House, and we're terminating you. It's employment at will, unless he has a contract that specifies the conditions which he can be terminated. But there is a due process argument, and that's what the White House has now cleared. They've corrected by having a policy about behavior, and they will provide a process when they're going to suspend or revoke a reporter's credentials. It's all fixed now.
It's all fixed. So there won't be any more problems with asking questions in the White House press conference room?
Oh, I expect there will be, because the policy that the White House put in place is that you are allowed one question and a follow-up at the privilege of the president, if the president allows it, and that you have to surrender the microphone upon request of an aide or a White House staffer. I don't see everybody going along with that policy. I've been watching press conferences for 40 years, and I just see them trying to do follow-up and run-on and second questions, and I see there being problems with it. But at least there's something for the White House to cite to when they want to suspend or revoke a credential. They can say, well, you continued to ask questions beyond your allowed one question, and you didn't surrender the microphone. Therefore, you're no longer welcome. This privilege is being restricted.
As far as I have heard, I believe it was 9 months or so before Trump actually sat before some reporters and took general questions. It was a long time between him having two press conferences.
He's not been as regular as some presidents, but that business is not required. It's hard for you to establish a standard. Some presidents love the press and some despise, and some are good and some are not. President Reagan didn't have a lot of excitement to be the press. He had difficulty hearing, but he was good when he did a press conference. If he was at his best, he did just fine with the press. Nixon didn't care for the press at all, as you
certainly not know that guy.
the different presidents have had different relationships with the press, but they're a necessary ingredient. We can't, as a citizenry, know what's going on in government. And if the press is not allowed to ask any questions and ask tough questions, then we're kind of at the mercy of what we're being told. And I don't think that would be healthy. I think even the people who find Acosta totally objectionable are going to have problems with us not having access to ask tough questions of our leadership.
I don't know if you follow anything of the European press system and their politicians, but I have heard them say that they are, the press there is ridiculously brutal, and the politicians are, you know, they're not forced to stand up and listen to it and answer questions, but they do. And they said it's a lot more hostile, not like screaming at them, but just that the questions are a lot tougher. The presidential press corps, they're just a little bit more friendly and maybe a little bit more softball questions to the president just to keep everything kind of happy and jovial. Do you have anything to add to that?
Only just with the British system, you know, you watch the parliamentary debates, you see a lot more give and take. The prime minister, of course, is a different system than our presidency. Their parliamentary system's different, but you see a lot more questions that you could never imagine being asked of an American president. So I would say that that in many regards it's probably tougher in terms of the questioning. Here my understanding is, having not been in the White House, but my understanding is that the press secretary briefs the press in terms of what the president's prepared to answer. And there's an expectation that you stay within the zone of where the president's been briefed. And if you don't do that, you tend not to be called on. That's what I've been told by people who've had access to White House officials.
But it's kind of funny because, and I'm sure this has happened other times, but this is significant. I'm following this whole thing going on significantly closer. And there have been times that a tweet will go out during like the press conferences, and someone will read something. They'll be like, "Hey, Mr. President," or "Miss Sanders, hey, what about this?" And they're like, "Where did that come from?" And Mueller has just issued an indictment for something, you know, something like that. And they're just completely blindsided by stuff. And you can just see the deer in the headlights thing go up.
Well, that's not a good position for a press secretary to be in terms of White House actions. They should be in the loop on as much as possible. But not White House actions. Of course, you wouldn't expect the White House to know everything that every official that's not White House related. But I have noticed in this White House that there has been the appearance of surprise by presidential announcements that are not known about, or cabinet announcements that are not known about, that the president says, "Well, no, that isn't our policy." It does seem like there's some lack of coordination and disunity among this White House.
31 indictments, I think, maybe 32.
I'm not even keeping count. It's all a sham, Andy.
It's all fake news. It's all a witch hunt. Sorry. All right. Hey, you ready for some articles?
let's do it.
All right. Well, here we go. This first article comes from NBC 12, NBC on our side, Richmond, Virginia, it says. Let's play this quick clip and we'll talk about it.
News. New at 6, a father of 5 says life on the sex offender registry has forced him and his family into homelessness. Now, many people may not be concerned with what someone on the registry goes through, but William Walker says he hopes by sharing details of his arrest and the collateral damage it's causing his kids, someone will rent him a place to live. The children are 5, 6, 7, 9, and 10. 4 boys and a girl, and mom and dad were evicted in October. They've exhausted a 3-week hotel stay from social services and are now emotional and homeless.
I cry. I hurt. I mean, it bothers me every day. My kids would never be in the street if it wasn't for this charge.
William Walker was labeled a violent sex offender back in 1999 in Maryland. He says the sex was consensual. He and his girlfriend lived together for a year and even worked at the same job.
I was 29. And she was? Trying to find out she was only 15 or something like that. But she told me she was 19.
This happened long before he and Chanel married and had kids.
I ain't do a day in jail in Maryland for this charge. I got 1 year unsupervised probation.
William was not required to register as a sex offender in Maryland. They've lived in Virginia since 2009 without problems, but William was pulled over for speeding. State police informed him that his name would go into the registry, and life got tough. Since their eviction, Chanel says landlords treat them like pariahs.
We're not slouches. We're none of that. Mommy. We are working parents. Mommy. Just trying to provide for our children. I'm not asking for people to feel sorry for us. I'm not asking people to have sympathy. We're just asking for a little help so that my children will be able to wake up Christmas morning, go to the Christmas tree, and open their presents.
The director of litigation at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society says some of these landlords may be breaking the fair housing law by refusing to rent to them.
If the conviction was more than 6 years ago, then it's likely not relevant. You have to look at how long ago this happened. You have to look at how old was the person who did it. In other words, there has to be an individualized assessment. If the housing provider does not do that, they're violating fair housing law.
For now, the family sleeps in their SUV when they can't find relief at a relative's home. They slept here just last night.
We got a few blankets in there, and I keep the car running with heat on. we lean the seat back, and we go to sleep.
Fair housing protection for sex offenders only applies to private housing. If you would like to help this family, send me an email at dwalker@nbc12.com. To see the entire interview explaining fair housing protections for sex offenders, look for this story on the NBC 12 News.
Wait, so this Fair Housing Act, is that just a local state thing, or is that a nationwide thing?
Thinking that that's Virginia, there's unless there's something federally that I'm not aware of, and it's been a number of years on housing and was quite familiar with federal fair housing, so I would suspect that's they're talking about Virginia. But there's okay. there's a slight silver lining in that story of the tragedy of it. The silver lining is, can you think of the time when a news station anywhere in the country has said, if you want to help this family, reach out to me? This is a first as far as I can remember.
Oh, yeah, I would say so, that they have taken a very, very soft stance on what the crime was. I mean, that's a pretty big age gap, but he says she said she was 19. I've always wondered if the person, what are you supposed to do? Like, hey, we're going to sleep together. I got to check your ID first. Was that like, that's ridiculous. Also in 99, this wasn't like the thing going on. That's what, 20 years ago? Come on, man. Close. What are you supposed to do with a guy that 20 years ago committed what he says consensual and didn't really get a whole lot of punishment for it? So I think we're going to talk about something similar. The DA must not have thought there was a lot of case there to go get any traction in. So he just got off with the 1 year of unsupervised probation.
If you assume everything in the story is true, which it may or may not be, but if everything is true, that he got a relatively mild sentence by today's standards. You wouldn't get a 29-year-old and a 15-year-old having consensual sex getting unsupervised probation in any jurisdiction in the country, as far as I can think of.
You would get 20 to life, probably.
So I suspect that I'm leaning toward the story being true or largely true. Mm-hmm. And he made the mistake of moving. And there again, you wouldn't think about that, because you would think, if you've never had to register, if you've never been required to register, you would think that whatever sentence you finished in Maryland would end the situation. I tell people, and this is a good time to remind them, if you get off of the registry in one state, that doesn't mean you don't have a registration obligation in another state. Other states have different reach back periods. It may be life that they reach back. It may be for a period of 10, 20, 30. I mean, you cannot assume that you're done with registration. It could be that he wouldn't have to register if he moved back to Maryland. It could be that the Maryland law has changed and he just didn't know it, and he actually does have a registration obligation. But if he doesn't have a registration obligation, it would seem like to me that going back to the state of conviction would be a significant consideration to make, rather than being homeless. Because if he doesn't have to register in Maryland, why on earth would you want to live in a state where you do?
Yeah, and Virginia, from my understanding, is one of the more challenging states.
Well, they certainly have some tough requirements there, and I think they're one of the 17 or 18 AWA compliant state. And AWA compliant means that you could be even beyond what the AWA requires, which most states have gone beyond it. But if you've at least met the minimum standards, and I believe they're on the list of compliant states, so you're going to have a tiered system. And if she was 15, depending on how Virginia decided to tier minors, he could be a lifetime offender of Virginia, and he perhaps wouldn't have to register at all in Maryland based on how old the conviction is. So he needs to do some unpacking of this through a competent legal professional.
There was the extra little clip from another voice in there. His name's Martin Wegbrett, the director of litigation at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. And he's saying that the landlords may be breaking the fair housing law. This is a dick move again. They're driving like a Suburban. It looked like a halfway decent maintained car. These are some pretty upstanding people. They don't appear to be like the challenge kind of person that you might rent to. Just freaking take their money and move on, man.
Well, if
take
it were
their
that
money
easy.
And give them a place to stay.
if it were that easy, though, it's not that easy, though, when you're running a community with 150 units and you've got people telling you that we don't want to live around that kind. If you have that kind here, we're not going to live here.
Right.
The public registry is what does the damage. There'd
Correct.
Be a lot of landlords who would not mind having their money if the ridicule that they were going to get from having them there did not come to be. But the public aspect of registration is what does it. And then people say that, well, I feel unsafe here because this person is a child predator. You heard what they had him labeled. It seemed like they said sexually violent.
Yes, offender. He was listed as a sexual a violent predator, SVP.
That would not be well received by the average apartment community. So when you put economics at work, which is what we are in America, we're a system based on freedom for economics, and we're reticent and hesitant to interfere with what private ownership is doing. They're saying this is a business decision. We can't have the risk of that here. We've got legal liability. We've got goodwill of our community. There's too many things that we don't want. I don't agree with it. I'm just merely saying this is from that perspective. And people will send emails saying it sounds like you're condoning what they're doing. I'm not condoning it. I'm saying I'm understanding where they're coming from.
And tell me your favorite expression. You're not telling the world what it should be. How does that expression go?
I tell people that when I tell you things, we don't live in the world the way it should be. We live in the world the way it is be. And that's the way it is be right now. It is difficult for landlords to have registered sex offenders in their communities with all the complexities that go with it, including constant law enforcement verifications, the internet registry, which causes them to get harassed. Why do you have that kind of person here? And I endured that when I was in property management. It was the very early beginning days of the registry, but only had a couple that have encounters. But that's what you encounter having a registrant in your community, and it's not fun.
Yeah, I know when I rented this particular apartment that I'm in, the landlord was very, very hesitant. He's, I think I have to tell the neighbors about you. I was like, I don't think you have to tell anybody. I really think. And he went back and forth and talked to other property managers that he knows and eventually came back and he said, I don't have to tell anybody. All right, you're in. It's like, whew. But he thought that he was going to have to somehow, or maybe I would have to tell the neighbors of my status. And he was worried on what kind of he wasn't going to do it. If he had to, he wasn't going to rent me the place. I mean, he wasn't going to not tell them. He was going to not rent me the place.
Oh, yep.
All right. Well, moving on to an article from Politico, and we have a voicemail message that will kind of sort of set us up, I suppose. So let's listen to William. Is it going to play?
Good evening. This is William from Tennessee again, and I listened to the most recent podcast, episode 52. And you were mentioning the First Step Act that Mitch McConnell has been stonewalling. Well, we've got another threat to that bill now, and this was posted on NARSL's website. And you have a Republican from Arkansas, Senator Tom Cotton, and he is using fear, that the fear tactic, if we pass this act, we could be letting sex offenders out of prison early. So now you've got Tom Cotton trying to use the sex offender scare tactic to completely derail a bipartisan supported bill. And it just seems like he's not below stooping to any level to try to derail this. And Narsal is urging anyone who will to call the Capitol switchboard at 202-224-3121. Ask for Senator Cotton's office, even if you're not from Arkansas, and voice your opposition to his position and make it known that this is something that affects the whole nation. And maybe we can get enough blowback against this man to shut him up. But he's trying to use the sex offender angle to kill the First Step Act. And I thought you guys would want to know that. Have a good one and keep up the good work.
Appreciate it, William. This only affects federal charges, correct?
That's correct.
So then doesn't this have, I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't sex offenders in federal custody, but isn't it the federal crimes for sexual offenses is much, there are many, many more in the states than there are in the feds.
It would be primarily your internet based crimes, your transportation.
Right.
Of a minor across state lines, or your transportation across state lines to have sex with a minor, the solicitation or attempt to do so, the transmission of pornographic images of a minor, those type of offenses, or the actual contact offenses, if there would be a federal jurisdictional hook, which would include Indian reservations and certain federal jurisdictions where the feds prosecute. But the bulk of the contact sex offenders are going to be in state's custody rather than federal custody.
So even like in theory, if this said let all of them out, it would be a proportionally pretty small number. That would be my take.
It would be a small number of the overall total, and it would be more non-contact offenders, which unfortunately people on our side in the advocacy believe that they should be treated less harshly. They typically are treated more harshly. You can get a lot more time for images than you can for actually having under federal law. That is, you can get, and even under some state law for that matter, but you can get more prison time for images than if you actually had the sex with the minor. But
right.
We're talking about a small universe of sexual offenders, and then there are adequate controls and safeguards according to the analysis. I haven't analyzed it myself, but people say that there's enough safeguards that the BOP would have the final say. The Bureau of Prisons would have the final say on anybody who got early release. But this is William has actually been working on that issue with Narsal. We're trying to drum up a little bit of support to overcome this Republican. It's not me filibustering it. It's not me demagoguing. We played last week, Senator. You want to cue that up again and play it just so people that weren't listening last week stay fresh with that little clip with Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, that the problem's on the Republican side. But you've got the senator from Arkansas who's got a small following of Republicans that want to kill the First Step Act, and those senators include Inhofe from Oklahoma, and I forgot the entire list, but it's a small group of them. It does have a number of Republicans supporting it, and Senator Graham thinks if they could get it to a vote, it would pass. But Mitch McConnell, the leader, doesn't want to have it devouring precious time with all this furious debate, because Senate procedures allow one senator to do an amazing amount of harm in terms of devouring time. So the rules permit extended debate, and that's what he's afraid of. And he says, we're not going to do it unless we can get a significant majority. Well, we've got that significant majority, but they're still doing it.
Right. This is from episode 51. You tell me where to cut it, because it's a little longer than you. It's 2 minutes and 30 seconds. Tell me when you want me to cut it.
Believe the majority leader is trying to quietly kill this bill in the lame duck?
No, not really, because Tom Cotton's had this view from day one. What we're talking about is basically creating a new sentencing system that will give African-American male and Hispanic male detainees a chance to get out of jail earning their way out of jail. They've been in jail 30 and 40 years for three nonviolent drug-related offenses, and change our sentencing system to make it more humane and more productive. Tom has been on the other side of this. There's 80 votes for this. It's the most important bipartisan piece of legislation in the Congress today. It would make prisons a better place to get people the skills they need to not go back to prison. And it will also change the way we put people in jail. The average sentence in America is eight times higher than anywhere else in the world. For nonviolent offenders, we've got people in jail for 30 and 40 years. Some of them need to get out of jail and go back to work. And I'm urging Mitch McConnell, put this bill on the floor. If you put it on the floor, we'll get 80 votes. We'll get most Republicans and almost all Democrats. And let's do it before the end of the year. And the president's behind it. So, Mr. President, pick up the phone and call the Republican leadership of the House and the Senate and say, we still run this place. Bring this bill to the floor. Senator Cotton can have his say, and we'll vote him down.
But this, you believe the president is going to have to start lobbying Mitch McConnell because yes. You guys have done everything you could, and you haven't been able to get him to budge?
Yeah, you know what? The country needs to heal here. And one way to bring this country together after the midterms is to focus on something that matters. I never dreamed that this many Republicans and Democrats would embrace sentencing reform and prison reform. Three strikes and you're out has not worked. Now's the time to get it right. Let's start 2019 on a positive note. I'm urging Senator McConnell to bring the bill to the floor of the Senate. It'll get 80 votes. Mr. President, pick up the phone and push the Republican leadership. The Republicans are the problem here. They're not the Democrats. Cory Booker has been very helpful.
That's where I wanted to go.
Yeah. Got it.
So it ain't old Crazy Larry saying it. It's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina that's saying that the Republicans were the problem. So all of our listeners out there who are overwhelmingly Republican, particularly in these states where we've got blockage coming, and that would be Texas, where you guys just reelected Cruz. Cornyn. It would be in Oklahoma with Inhofe. It would be in Iowa. I think Ernst has got a consternation about it. Arkansas with Cotton. Light these phone lines up and tell them just what Senator Graham said. This is important. It's too important to let it die. If it dies this session, we probably won't be able to get this done for a long time because the polarization is going to widen. In January, you got a more conservative Senate and a more liberal House, and it's going to be even more difficult to get a bill that both of those chambers can agree after the first of the year.
I suspect that it'll be more like Inhofe bringing in the snowball, saying that climate change isn't real, so there'll be more snowballs being thrown across the two chambers.
It's quite possible. I mean, politics is strange. You can have the amazing coalitions form, but my fear is it was killed in 2016 in the heat of the campaign when Trump became the law and order president. Everybody got cold feet, and now it's dying at the end of the session, and they could technically stay in session all the way until the end of the year if they like. They generally don't, but after the end of the year, a new Congress is sworn in, and all this stuff dies, and this has to start all over from scratch with new members who are more conservative on the Senate side and more liberal on the House side, and trying to get legislation out of a more polarized body may be extremely tough.
So and to explain that, so the liberal side would then try and make it more reformish, and then the conservative side would make it more punitive-ish. They're going to have to reconcile it. They're going to have to agree to the same bill, correct?
That's correct. You're going to have the House saying already this is a very weakened down, watered down version to compromise to get this far along, and it's likely that the more liberal House is going to say this doesn't do anything. Why bother? And the conservatives are going to say, well, we're not going to do that because it's going to turn loose a tidal wave of criminality. And it's going to be tough, but let's hope I'm wrong. Let's hope that if it doesn't get through, that it can be brought back in 2019. But I fear that this is going to die and be a dead initiative.
So Narsol.org, Narsol.org. There's an article there. I will have a link in the show notes to it. But otherwise, if you make it over there, there's information there, phone numbers and stuff that you can dial in and reach your
politician. And we're going to do a press release. We're going to do a press release Monday, which will hit far and wide, and hopefully that'll draw some more attention to the media. It may be negative attention, but we're going to try to highlight that this is too important for it to die.
And just real quick, I'm going to ask you a quick off the cuff question. Are we associated with Narsal?
Only in that I am on the board, but this podcast is an independent production and it doesn't, Narsal has nothing to do with us.
That's what I wanted you to say. I need you to mostly drive the bus on this article from law.com titled "Complaint over Flawed Sex Offender Housing Assistance is Rejected by New York Court of Appeals." So here's a guy that was locked up and he was given really, really limited resources in trying to find a place, and he should have been able to get out earlier. So he filed a suit, I think.
That's what I think. He alleged that the requirements on their Department of Corrections and whatever they call that agency in New York, that they were required, the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision did not fulfill its statutory obligation to assist him. And he alleged that all they did was reviewed his proposed addresses and said, nope, not that one, not that one, and not that one. And he alleged that having limited access to internet and telephone calls, that he really couldn't do a whole lot more, and that they should be doing more. And the state court of appeals, now don't misunderstand that terminology, because most of the time when you hear that, that refers to a mid-level appellate court. You have trial court at the subject matter jurisdiction where you initiate the case, the trial courts. Then you have an intermediate layer of appellate court review, and then you have the final level within a state, and it's usually referred to as the Supreme Court. In New York, this is their Supreme Court. It's like Maryland.
Okay.
They call it the Court of Appeals, but this is the final authority on this. And the New York's highest tribunal said, nope, they did all they had to do in terms of the statute. They interpreted the statute not to require any more than what they had done. It's kind of like that, we have a right in my state to have a blood draw on a DWI. But it's up to you to perfect that. The system doesn't have to make that happen. So you have to figure out. I mean, can you name the list of the blood drawing companies you have right now? Do you carry a card around with those in your pocket?
I don't, but I know at least one of them.
Right, but if you got thrown in the clink right now, could you call a blood drawing company?
Absolutely not.
Well, and neither could anyone else. But our court said, well, you have the right to it, but the jail doesn't have to set it up for you. You have the right to contact any blood drawing company and have them come down and take a blood sample. And it's up to you to make that happen. And that's kind of the way that the Supreme Court of New York, although it's the Court of Appeals of New York, has said that you've got all the assistance the statute visualized. Now, the lawmakers can fix this if that's not what they intended. They can say, well, no, actually, we're going to be more specific. We're going to require that our caseworkers and case managers do the following. And that would be what I would encourage, and that might be possible for that to happen. But and then there's another angle of the litigation. You could assert possibly that you have a right to release when your day comes, that your detention beyond that is unconstitutional. I mean, there may be some legal claims that can be asserted, but the easiest thing to do, not the easiest, but the most efficient way would be to have the legislature provide more clarity in terms of what they want, the way of assistance and helping people rehabilitate. And that should be something you could get bipartisan agreement on, because I'm assuming that conservatives like to save money, and we agree that having someone out working and paying taxes is more cost efficient than being in prison. So I would assume they would support providing that transition assistance. And I'm assuming that the liberals would support it, because it's the bleeding heart thing to do, is to have people out of jail once they've done their time.
Yeah, this guy was like past a like initial portion of his sentence, so he was like eligible for parole or probation, and he couldn't get out because he couldn't get an address.
Yes, he was eligible to be released, but right. But like I said, I think that a true conservative that held to their values would say, we want, once they're eligible, unless there's some compelling reason, we would want them out, because I would rather them be paying taxes to me than me paying taxes to them. That just seems like a no-brainer to me.
And my personal experience with this particular type of deal is it's impossible to get an address from behind the walls. I mean, you obviously can't run around and dial 45 different landlords and see where it is, try and get addresses and prices and see if they'll work with you, any of that. It's impossible. You would have to have either someone on the street or your caseworker trying to help you out. But if they're not obligated to, then they just go, yeah, try this number. And what do you do? Supposed to write a letter with a self-addressed stamped envelope for them to write back saying yay or nay? And that takes you 2 weeks to do that turnaround. And by then they've rented the place to somebody else.
I don't know. Well, I plucked out one quote from the article. It's just record, as the record in this case vividly demonstrates, the principal assistance DLC provided Mr. Gonzalez was allowing him to periodically submit a list of guesses to a parole officer whose function was to enter these guesses into a computer and report back to Mr. Gonzalez had failed again. That doesn't sound like much. DSS did not give, DLCCS did not give him access to its system to allow him to search for himself. It did not provide him a map, a list of potential neighborhoods, or even a hint as to how to look for available compliant housing. That's kind of sad, isn't it?
You do go behind the walls to like restrict your access. Like, I mean, they're taking away your freedom. One of your freedoms would be figuring out how to find housing, right?
Yes, I would think so.
It's a dick move. I mean, what are you supposed to do? Like, you've potentially, I can't find where it says how much time he's done. If he's done 2 years, he probably still has contacts from family and friends on the street. If he's done 15 years, he very possibly does not. What is he supposed to do? He would have to get to the street to try and figure out how to find a place on the street to stay.
It's an example of our many failures we have, and this goes on across the country. We look at, we frequently harp about the South and how harsh they are. Well, we pluck this one out because it's not the South. And it appears though they're just as bad on reintegration in terms of providing assistance. And I didn't have a chance to read the opinion, and there was a dissent, and I'd like to read the dissenting opinion and see what they said. But I imagine there was some scathing language about how silly this is.
From whose side, though? From the person trying to find the stuff?
The dissenting judge would have disagreed with the majority opinion. The majority opinion said it was okay that they had provided sufficient help. I'm imagining that the judge that dissented said, you guys are nuts.
Isn't that going to go right back to like Gorsuch saying if the legislator wanted them to do it, then they would have put that language in there? So he's going to side with that the law, that they did what they were supposed to do.
That would be one way of looking at it. Since I didn't read this in its entirety, I don't know what the statute says that they're required to do, but the court found they did the minimum necessary, that they met the requirements of the statute. The legislature can enlarge the statute and make it clear if they want to provide greater reintegration assistance, they can do that. But it would be kind of legislating from the bench if that's not required by statute.
That's where I was just about to go with that. So then do we want the judges to save us from the laws that we made by the government that we elected?
Well, most conservatives would say they don't want legislating from the bench. Therefore, they need to get into the legislature and clean this up and make it clear what they want the DLCCS to provide.
Right. I know. I'm just playing devil's advocate over here.
Yeah. So, well,
I'm demonstrating to you that I've learned from you. I'm learning how these things work. I'm demonstrating that to you.
It's amazing, though, that a lot of our people would want legislating from the bench on something like this. They would say, well, clearly they should. But that would be a legislative question. If they want them to provide more specific service assistance provided, then that needs to go through Albany. And that needs to be grafted into the statute. And they need to say what services are required to be provided. If you're going to get $100 and a bus ticket, the statute has to say that. Right. Otherwise, they're not required to provide it. That's not to say that some prison wardens may have a fund that they solicit donations from. I've heard of this around the country, rarely, but I have heard of it where they create a gate money fund, and they have some gate money for people that they decide to give it to on their own volition. But if you want that to be public policy, you have to make that through the process.
Absolutely. So are you ready to go over to the Washington Post?
I sure am.
Here's another article about the First Step Act. It's called We Have Nothing to Fear from Federal Sentencing Reform. This is from Wonk Blog Analysis is what the subsection of the paper is talking about. And I guess there are people that are fussing about the First Step Act and the reworking of this thing that would let just so many violent offenders out on the street. And I think it says that there are 1,700 people that are released every day. And the First Step Act would be the equivalent to having about 3 or 4 extra days of prison release during the year. So 1,700 people, we'll call that 100. So it would be like an extra, 20 people perhaps that have violent tendencies would be released per day, if I've done my math roughly right. Yeah, and yeah, you should never do your math in your head while you're streaming a podcast.
I would say I've not done the mathematical analysis, but it's a narrowly focused and it does have checks and balances according to what I've read. And I think it's going to enlarge the amount of good time they get a little bit from the current 54 days per year. But I just don't see the fear. When you get something that's been vetted for as long as this has, chances are there are sufficient controls that it's not going to be turning loose a tidal wave of crime. It's probably so minuscule that we won't even be able to detect it.
Right. And then there's another provision that, reduces the sentencing disparity between powder and crack cocaine, which is basically like white versus black drug, if you want to put it like crudely like that.
Yes. It says in this Washington Post article, the provisions of the First Step Act make the largest number of prisoners eligible for early release also were narrow in scope. The act clarifies that prisoners get up to 54 days off their sentence each year for good time credits earned by following prison rules and participating in rehabilitation programs. The law has been on the books for some time, but it's been interpreted by the Bureau of Prisons to impose a 47-day limit. If implemented retroactively, this change would perhaps free 4,000 prisoners. So what this particular provision is, they've already done their time. There's apparently a disagreement about whether they get 47 or 54 days a year. And if you give them the 54 versus the 47, then that would shave off. That would cause people to roll into being, they're going to be released anyway. They would just be released slightly earlier, but they're coming out anyway. But that tidal wave of crime, if that's what's going to happen, that's going to be released anyway.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's a bunch of hooey, but this is where we are with our political system. And I can assure you that Tom Cotton believes he's representing the views of the majority of residents of Arkansas.
Some hard numbers behind the statistics. So it says that there's 1.5 million people behind bars in the United States, and 12.5% of those are in federal prison. So we're only talking about 200,000 people, give or take, that this actually applies to.
Yes. And with that the universe, it's very small than the 200,000. They're not talking about releasing 200,000. They're talking about releasing a very small number of the 200,000, possibly up to 4,000 early. But those 4,000 are going to be released anyway, just slightly later.
And why are we assholes in the United States and want to put people in prison 8 times longer, as Lindsey Graham said, 8 times longer than other Western nations?
Well, I did that presentation in Dallas a few years ago, and I don't understand that, because we're the compassionate society that believes in forgiveness. And why we incarcerate at that level, I can't explain it. I would say that it's been drilled into us by fear mongering for the last couple of decades, starting in the 80s, last 3 decades, about how we need to clamp down on crime. And that's the message that's resonated with people. And the answer to everything is to lock people up for longer. That's been our solution to crime. And some would argue it's worked. The crime rate has been going down the whole time we've been locking up more and more people.
Go read Freakonomics and you'll come up with a whole lot of alternative ideas as to why crime went down.
But they will tell you statistically.
I know.
Since we've been locking up more people, we've got a lower crime rate. You can't deny that.
No, and you know, I mean, it would be really hard. Like, if you are in prison, you can't go rob the convenience store. It is pretty much an impossibility.
The question becomes, could we have had a lower crime rate in a better society without locking up 1.8 million, 2.2 million people? Could we have achieved similar results? We'll never know that because we didn't try.
Right. And we just, you know, it started in the 80s, whatever, with Reagan and being, you know, 3 strikes and all that stuff, and then got signed by Clinton. And it's just been a tidal wave ever since.
So Well, I've cited those statistics. When Reagan was sworn in, we had 20,000 people in federal prison, where that population had been for a 40-year period from 1940 to 1980. It had hovered between 18 and 22,000, depending on the economic conditions. And by the time Reagan left office, the small government conservative, he left office with 57,000. So he practically tripled in 8 years the federal prison population that had been steady for 40 years. And then by the time Clinton left office, we were over 200,000, or right at 200,000. And it continued to go up through the Bushes and through the first term of Obama. And then with Obama's reforms on the crack powder disparity, and by simply changing the way the U.S. attorneys prosecute, by not requiring them to prosecute the highest possible offense and seek all the enhancements, the tools that are available in the federal structure, they were able to bend that population down. And we started going down in the last half of Obama's presidency. That continued through 2017 under Trump. I think it might even continue through 18. I haven't followed the numbers close enough. But if the policies of Jeff Sessions, which were, I'm assuming, approved by the president to seek the maximum penalty and to stack charges and to file every enhancement that you possibly can, I can't see how that would continue unless the sentencing reform bill, this first step, is enacted. Because it seems like to me, if you don't fund early reentry for the final 6 months mm-hmm. of people's federal sentence, if you cut the funds for that, which they've done, which keeps people in prison longer, and you stack charges and you seek maximum penalties, I don't know how the population would keep going down.
Tilt your head and you know, maybe cock one eye closed. Maybe that'll work, and you'll see the numbers the way that they do.
Well, yeah, but that's I'm predicting that if it does go down this year without any reform, this will be the last year, because we'll still be on the inertia of the it takes a while to get people charged, convicted, and serving time. Mm-hmm. And the people that were sentenced in the previous 8 years, a lot of those are still kicking out of the system. These things don't magically change overnight. So the inertia of the previous 8 years may carry a while longer in the federal prison system. But the policies that we're following today, with maximum sentences and not giving people their community reentry, the average of 6 months that federal prisoners typically get on the tail end of their sentences, we're going to have more people in prison. Sorry, I hate to tell you, but that's the way it's going to happen.
No doubt. And then this next article comes from The Appeal. And man, why don't we have King Alexander on here to help us talk through this one? And we totally need to get somebody on here that speaks in a really thick Cajun accent so they could read this article in a I can't do a Cajun accent. New Orleans prosecutor calls, go ahead. You can't? No, I know. That's not even close. They're like that whole Bayou talk thing. I mean, I lived there for 6 years in New Orleans, and I have no clue. I've never been able to imitate the Mon Cheri kind of, no idea. It's a very hard accent to imitate. To me, it does. But the New Orleans prosecutor calls for a new bail fund extremely disturbing. What do you think about the idea of, like, maybe a nonprofit or something that just continually collects money from the citizenry to try and help people fund their way out of pre-detention stuff, what's the word I'm looking for your bond detention. Hearing stuff pre-trial detention that could help you bond your way out. Cause there's so many people that just take a plea because they're stuck there for 3 months and they can't make a $5,000 bond. But so maybe there's some nonprofit that would kick in some funds and help you make bonds so you can get yourself back in order. Does that sound like a bad idea?
Well, according to the Orleans Parish District Attorney Leon Canizero, well, I hope I got that close, he says this New Orleans Safety and Freedom Fund has been operating more than a year and it's bailed out more than 200 people is disturbing, because these people, according to him, his theory is, since they have not put their own money up, that they have a higher propensity to commit crime. That's his theory. That if you put your own money at stake. Now, I'm not going to take a position on that because I have not done the scientific research or seen the studies. But his theory is, without your money at stake, that your propensity to commit another crime while you're pending trial would be higher.
But it's okay for Andrew Zimmerman to get all kinds of funding after the Trayvon Martin debacle in Florida.
Is that his name? Something Zimmerman.
It's Andrew Zimmerman. We share a similar name, so it didn't miss me by much.
All right. Well, I remember the Zimmerman part, but I didn't remember the first name. Well, that would be different because you understand he was the victim. That Trayvon was not the victim. Trayvon was the instigator. I don't know why you don't understand that.
But we covered an article just a week or two ago of a guy with the exact same name as someone else. And he's like, I can't get a job because my name is John Smith. And this guy was convicted of heinous crime and his name's John Smith. I'm not that guy, but I can't get a job. He could get locked up. And why can't he get some funding?
Well, I was being facetious about the Zimmerman.
I know.
So I was trying to derail the conversation a little bit.
I know.
Zimmerman, in my mind, not sitting on the jury, I didn't see all the evidence, but from what was presented publicly, following a person and shooting them, I think that jury may have gotten it wrong. Don't know that you need permission to walk to the convenience store and get a pop and some what do they call those candies that he was buying. I don't think you really need permission in America to do that, and I don't think you owe anybody an explanation. I don't think you owe anybody an explanation of where you're going. But back to this about the Freedom Fund. back to this Freedom Fund. I don't understand the district attorney's consternation completely, because I don't have any evidence that would convince me that a person on bail is more dangerous than a person sitting. If their bail was made by their brother versus made by the Freedom Foundation, the Freedom Fund's money, I don't understand how very few people, I don't think, post their own bonds. Could we agree on that? When you get in jail, you should call somebody to get help with bail, right?
That's probably fair. I mean, it could be at least 50. I mean, like, I'll concede 50-50. I mean, I don't know. That sounds legit.
My experience as being criminal defense is that they usually get help posting their bail.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're getting help from the Freedom Fund, that somehow escalates your danger to the community because you don't have any skin in the game. Well, okay, if you get money from your brother, Bob, that's not your skin in the game either. And I haven't seen the statistics that a person who's out on bail regarding who paid the bail, that there's any support for his position. But I think the organization has every right to exist, because when you're sitting in jail pending trial, we talked about this with the Manafort case, where he was allowed the opportunity to
computer
participate
and
more fully in his defense. In most county jail settings across the country, there is very little, if any, difference in how you're treated. Those people that are sentenced, waiting to be picked up to go to the intake and diagnostic center in that state, are treated the same as the person who was arrested yesterday and can't post a $10,000 bond. They all wear the same clothing. They all eat the same food. They all have the same restricted access to visitation, to the telephones, to the internet, and whatnot. So this fund is trying to say, we recognize the statistics do show that those who are out on bail get more favorable plea offers, and they have a better shot at being more fully participatory in their defense. That is a given. And I don't think anybody will call the podcast or email us and say that's not true, or we have to actually prove that, because that has been proven. I don't understand why a district attorney who believes in justice, who put his hand on that Bible, would object to a person having a shot at equal justice under the law. I thought that's what it was all about.
Because it's going to make his job harder.
Oh.
So he wants to get convictions. He just wants to put another notch on the bedpost. He just wants to get convictions, and having somebody locked up, you have more leverage than having them out on the street running around. We're assholes. Larry, we just have a really flawed system, and I don't know that there's any hope unless the yous and the me's and all the thousands of listeners, if those people would step up and try and make this change.
I don't understand why you just don't leave this country. All I hear is griping from you.
It's because someone won't fund my way out. If I could get an organization, we'll call it, let's see here. What's it called? What's this place called? The Freedom Fund. Yes. If they would help me get out, then I would leave.
Yeah, but why would you want to try to make the country better? Why don't you just leave rather than talking about our problems and looking for solutions?
Somalia. That sounds like a great place to go.
So, but that's my reaction to people that say that. we were born here and we don't have to leave, and we have every right to try to improve our country and to shed light and focus on things that need to be changed. And that's what we're doing here. This is a flawed system. We have monetary bail has serious flaws. And is there a perfect solution? No. The solutions that are being tried where they've abolished bail, they have their flaws also in terms of people sit in jail longer when they can't post a bond. They sometimes lose their jobs. They have all these electronic apparatuses strapped to them, and that oftentimes have costs associated with them, where with the bond they'd pay one time, they might pay for a whole 18 months. I mean, there's no perfect system. But what's wrong with us exploring, trying to figure out ways to improve the system where we do agree that there are flaws in it? What is so unpatriotic about that?
Yeah, I don't know. It seems like it would be more patriotic to make the system mo better.
That's what I thought. When we offer criticisms, it's because we love the country and we want it to be better. We want to live up to those ideals that everybody's equal under the law, and that people get a fair shake regardless of what birth canal they came through. We want that to happen. That doesn't mean that we hate the country. It means we admire greatly those words that are in those precious documents, and we want to get as close as we can to actually seeing those documents followed for everybody.
Yep.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Well, this next article comes from The Collegian, I think. I hope I haven't butchered that to death. What do you think about the idea of going to people and presenting them with a survey, then having them watch a brief video that explains the facts, and then having them take the survey again? Do you think that that could potentially win over and change some people's minds on really any subject, whether it's climate change, whether it's abortion debate, same-sex marriage, whatever? Specifically, we're talking about the sex offender laws. Do you think that that would work?
Oh, I love the idea. I love the idea. I wonder how soon we can start this and mass produce it and mass, because apparently it had an impact.
Yeah, I think so. Here's a guy in a California school who's doing a master's thesis, and he's picking really controversial subjects for his thesis. And he put together a survey that specifically asked about what people thought about the registry and the people that are on it, what the recidivism rate is, and things of that nature. And he has a 6-minute video, and I think he got some of the clips from the California Sex Offender Management Board. I guess actually that's where the video comes from. And it describes the statistics of it. Are they all cut from the same cloth? Do they all like automatically reoffend as soon as they hit the street? And he gives it to these millennials. I guess maybe these aren't even millennials. Are they millennials if they're in college now? Millennials, Gen Xers, whatever it is.
I think there's a new generation now.
I forget what they're called. Anyway, so them young cats that are like 20-ish and going to college. And after they watch the video, they come back and they're like, oh, I didn't realize it was like that. I think we should change the way these laws work. Hey, this is a novel concept. So what we need, Larry, then, if this is the case, we need all you old people to die off so we can change the laws with the young people. Oh, wait, they don't vote. Damn it.
That is the perennial problem with the young people, is they're erratic voters until they get older. And they have to be inspired, and an inspirational figure has to come along. And we don't have those often enough for young people to stay connected. But I like this assuming this was a valid study group, but you do this and you come out with so many minds changed. Why not? Let's try it in Georgia.
Okay. I think I want to say, you know, I read this articles. Yeah. He surveyed more than 400 students on campus in the spring of 2018.
Yeah,
that's a pretty decent sample size.
Yeah. That's a statistically significant sample.
And then I also want to give a shout out to Will. He's posted a bunch of times in the comments, and he left plugs for the podcast in the comments. So I really, really appreciate that. That's good times.
Oh, in the comments on this article?
Correct. If you go down there, you'll see one that has a video, like just half the frame of a video of a YouTube video. And then just below that, a couple links down, you'll see a link to the podcast.
Is that the one that says A plus computer?
That is the one.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, so thank you for that, William. And I mean, I don't know how could Narsol perhaps fund a nationwide television ad campaign or like a YouTube ad campaign to have some sort of 30-second infographic thing posted out there to try and get people to question what's going on?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, not knowing what the cost of funding would be. We have very, very meager resources, but
sure,
all options are on the table. In terms of,
yeah.
This is a three-prong attack. It's litigation, legislation, mm-hmm. and education.
Right.
And we don't do enough of all of those things. There's far too little litigation. There's far too little education. And there's virtually almost no legislating going on in terms of positive reforms. The legislative efforts are going end up being focused on killing bad legislation. Where we have operations around the country, you're too busy trying to kill bad things. You really can't do a whole lot positive. You're on a constant mission of don't let this get through. It's going to make matters worse.
Yeah. Well, I do want to then move on. This is my favorite article of the night by far. This one wins the. This is insanity. I can't even pronounce where this comes from. Kumarebi Post. Here is a situation where you have minors being polygraphed, and one of my hot buttons in this podcast is about the polygraph and just like the level of garbage that it is. It is at the very top of my list of things that we should remove from practice across all aspects. And there's just one little thing in there that just absolutely drives me crazy. It says the youngest child reportedly tested was 7 years of age. You're going to put a 7-year-old on a polygraph machine? I cannot fathom how you actually do this.
I find it, I don't even know if I can find words that would be suitable for this program to how objectionable I find this. This is to me like interviewing a juvenile, and particularly someone that young, but a juvenile is largely protected by having to have a parent or a guardian present. I can assure you that these polygraphs were not done with the parent or guardian present. I'd be very surprised. A juvenile mind, as we know, is not very well developed for this type of interchange. And what you would have would be a lot of confessions at the end of the polygraph, because the juvenile mind would not be. If adults confess at the numbers that they do after they are told that they're deceptive, what do you think would happen to a juvenile examinee when they were told that they were deceptive?
They would make up all kinds of stories to please the adults in the room, basically, I think.
Well, they could do that, but just being told that you're showing deception and we know that you're lying, that's what trips up most adults. I'm waiting for that petition for someone to send me. Let me make the offer again. If someone can send me a petition in writing to revoke someone's probation or parole, and all it says is show deception on polygraph, and listen carefully, that's all the petition can say. It can't say that they admitted to subsequent violations, because then that's what the revocation is based on. That's the motion. But if someone can show me that we have a petition where it says that they failed to show deception on polygraph, therefore we're seeking revocation of supervision, I'm wanting to see those, and I got a challenge out there for one of those. No one has shown me yet that. Now, what they have shown me is they've been kicked out of treatment for failing polygraphs. That's not the same thing. They've been discontinued for treatment. But what the juvenile offender is going to do when they're more likely to do, if the adults already do this and say, yeah, you got me. Yeah, I was out after curfew. Yeah, I was online. Yeah, well, that's what sends you away, is the admission that you make. I would think that a juvenile offender, particularly if you go into the very tender years of 14 or below, 15, 14 below, you're going to have a lot of admissions once they're told that they show deception and this massive machine knows. If we got 40 and 50 and 60 year olds doing it, I can assure you that the juveniles would just collapse under that kind of pressure. So please send me a petition on this. I'm waiting for one.
This one, the polygraph test is right up there with so many other things of pseudoscience. It is so high up there, and I just absolutely hate every second of it, and it makes me really, really angry.
Well, how did we manage back during the Reagan administration? And of course, we had a Democratic Congress that was more liberal than Reagan, but we managed to get a bipartisan agreement, and polygraphs as pre-employment conditions were severely restricted. The government still allowed to use them, but for the private sector, pre-employment polygraphs all but vanished back in the 80s. How probable would we be able to go up against this polygraph industrial complex and do away with these stupid things? I think it's going to be a tough one, but to me, I've come around to believing that they're probably voodoo, but they still serve the purpose that we used them for, which was to get our clients to confess so that we would know.
Yeah, it's effective at a boo game of scaring you into thinking that the big bad machine is going to tell you that you lied, but it doesn't tell you that you lied. It tells you that you had some sort of response to the question. That's it. You could show somebody some horrific picture of someone being slashed and hacked to death, and then you'd be like, wow, you had some kind of response to that. You're being deceptive. I was watching a video, man, but showed deception.
But why did they always confess after we confronted them with the results? Every single person that showed deceptive always said, yeah, I reckon you got me.
Because you scared them. I mean, you could just kind of browbeat somebody to death. If you ever watch, you don't watch movies, but if you ever go watch the movies, Meet the Parents or Meet the Fockers is what it's called. And, I always forget his name. It's not Al Pacino, the other one. Those two actors always gets me. Anyway, I'll remember his name eventually. Super duper long time actor. He's probably in his 70s now. Robert De Niro's the guy. And he's looking at the guy that's trying to date his daughter. And he just like super duper stern look. And he's like, I can do a polygraph just on my own. I can just watch you and tell you if you're lying. That's all it is. You're intimidated by it. That's all the thing does is intimidate you into saying, yeah, I did that thing.
Okay. So you're believing that our clients told us a lie just because we said you showed deception. They told us what we wanted to hear. You believe they actually didn't do the crimes?
No. I'm not saying it that way. I'm saying that they lied to you up front, but then you put the big bad machine on that. You presented them with the boo game and they came clean.
Right, but I mean, that was the whole purpose.
It works from that. I know, but so you didn't have to have like the machine. You could have had some other way to. I know, but you could have had a bullshit machine and it would have worked. You could have just had what's the difference between a bullshit machine and a bullshit machine? They're the same thing. You could have had some fake thing with just some wires and stuff hooked up that did. I can't. It's not even possible to describe that because that's all it is. But you scared the person into copping to the crime. It would be the same thing. So yes, does it have the desired effect? Yes, but that doesn't make it effective. Because
it's pretty effective if they admit it.
I know. I understand that. So like, but if you change your perception of the world, like there's just a problem with it from a scientific standpoint. If it works, it works. But chiropractic care doesn't work either, but it makes you feel good. But it's not like you're going to realign your spine and you're going to fix some ingrown toenail. That's also garbage. Yes, send me all your emails that chiropractic care is great. They're not real doctors. They go take a correspondence course for 2 years. It's not real.
Well, there are people who tell you that they were laid up in the bed for 3.5 years and couldn't get out every day until they saw their chiropractor for the last 6 months.
Yes.
And now they're playing football and playing basketball and they're living the high life.
Absolutely.
Is that all in their head?
I would then argue that it is something along the lines of that it's in their head that somebody came in and touched their spine the right way and cracked their knuckles the right way. And now they can go do the things. Acupuncture's garbage. All this stuff fits into the same category of boo game, garbage, pseudoscience, nonsense.
Uh-huh.
That's my rant.
All right. So, I can't wait to see how many emails you get this week.
Larry at Registry Matters Cat. That's who they should send them to?
So we're not, unless we skip some of these articles, we're not going to have time for this big main event that we have.
Well, we should probably just skip to the main event then. Let's. I think we can cut it. I don't think there's anything else that's. Can we cover the Delaware thing real quick?
Sure.
So we have this other article from the Appeal, and we'll just touch on this one really quick. You have, like, Delaware is the second smallest state. How do you even have any prisoners in a state with, like, you know, with like, it's like the size of a neighborhood. But just a couple things where the CERT team goes in, you know, there's some kind of riot or whatever. But you got somebody, prisoners also described being stomped, kicked, spit on, and punched in the face and stomach. Some said they were ambushed by corrections officers in their cells. They took off my glasses and stomped on them, then sprayed pepper spray in my eyes, nose, and mouth. Why do we treat people like this?
Well, just for those who are not familiar with Andy's hyperbole, Delaware has just shy of 1 million people, which is larger larger than Wyoming, larger than Nebraska. I mean, not Nebraska, excuse me, I misspoke. Larger than Wyoming, larger than Alaska in terms of population. And it's a very densely populated state because the number of people they have is, they're pretty cramped, because it is a fairly small state. But I can't answer that question about what makes us do that to another human being. I don't know. I think it must say something about who works in prisons, if assuming that is true. Did you observe that when you were in the care of the DOC? Did that kind of thing happen?
You make it sound like in the care of the DOC. Yes, they cared for me. Yeah, it was definitely a really stellar environment. I mean, you know, when you have people that are trying, you know, they'll lock the door. They had some silliness where they actually had handles that, like, you could actually, like, grab and tie something around. So they cinch a bunch of sheets together, and then they tie the door. The door you would pull to open it. So they were able to actually, like, lasso and tie the door shut. You're going to get the CERT team called in on you when you do that. But I can pretty much guarantee you that people's locker boxes are going to end up running out after a handful of days, maybe cut off the water. I don't know. You know, I mean, you could kind of go after them with some soft approaches, and they're going to eventually calm down.
You observed those horrendous tactics there that you were describing in this article. I have
definitely seen the CERT team coming in and doing their thing and marching around the campus like they're some sort of like big brigade of military force, and they look kind of silly. But I mean, they're intimidating because they're in black and they got like their M16 looking guns with their paintball guns, whatever. They're intimidating looking. And you think that if you do make the wrong move, someone's going to shoot you from across the room with a paintball gun, which A is going to hurt. And then the pepper spray is going to come out and you're not going to be happy about it.
Yeah, this is where they've had a uprising for, aren't they going? This is one of the units where they've had the protesting for better conditions.
Sure. I think that's what the whole thing is talking about. This lawsuit claims Delaware prisoners are still being beaten, stripped, and tortured months after uprising. Meanwhile, the abysmal medical care that helped spark the riot persists. You have taken over these people's lives. You have put them behind bars where they are incapable of caring for themselves. And then you treat them like shit, and you then further not care for them, and they eventually will get mad.
Well, now the very infamous Joe R. Pyle had an answer for that. He said, if you don't like our accommodations, don't come back.
And he got reelected for what, 40 years?
Well over, I think between 28 or 32 years. Yeah, he was out there a long time.
So apparently we Americans like to treat people like poop.
Well, at least it appears that way in Delaware and in Maricopa County, Arizona.
And they did have that recall election finally go through. The recount election. They finally certified, and it's one of the rare times that a recount actually changed the results of the person that conceded.
Somebody in the Arizona Senate race with mm-hmm. Kyrsten Sinema and whatever her name was.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I can't. The military chick who was running on the conservative ticket.
So Arizona's changing demographically.
Because all the the snowbirds are moving in that direction, I guess.
And so let's have the main event tonight.
All right. This is a case out of so much stuff comes out of North Carolina. It is probably like the ground zero of cases, it would seem to me, because just so much stuff comes out of there. And here's a case. It's called Stein versus Meredith. Or Meredith versus Stein. Which way does it go? It goes Meredith versus Stein. And here you have a case. Oh, you know, Larry, you just set up because you're going to be better at it.
The case, the issue is something that affects all registrants across the country, because at one time or another, people are going to consider moving from one jurisdiction to another. And the question perennial comes up, what will my registration obligations be in that state? And I always give everybody the same answer. They'll be what that state tells you that they are.
Right.
And of course, they get irritated that I give them that answer, but that's the basic answer, because your registration obligations, since they're civil and regulatory, they would be like your vehicle when you take it from one state to the other. You may not pay an ad valorem tax in one state. You may pay an ad valorem, or in other words, a valuation tax on your vehicle. In some states, you just may pay a registration fee. In some states, you may pay a registration fee, and you may pay a vehicle inspections fee. But all those things are state specific. Well, it's the same thing when you carry your person across state lines. You've had one set of conditions in the regulatory scheme where you were living, and then you're going to have to, those are going to be translated, because there's no state that can list all the offenses of the entire country and have them properly translated. So what happens is, when you move to a new state, there are issues that come into play. Is my offense covered? If my offense is covered, what period of time will I register? For the states where everybody's lifetime, that's not a particular complex answer there in terms of how long I have to register. If your offense is covered by Florida law, since everyone is registered for life in Florida, we know how long you'll have to register. You'll have to register for life if you move from Vermont to Florida. We can easily do that. But if you move to a state where they have varying registration periods, then what your offense is equivalent to is important, and that's what Meredith versus Stein is about. Meredith is the petitioner, and Stein is the respondent and the Attorney General of North Carolina. There's a lot of litigation out of North Carolina because that is where we have a good legal team. Narsal's primary attorney is based in Durham, North Carolina, and he's anxious and chomping at the bit to go after low-hanging fruit. And this is a basic one about due process. Since North Carolina has language that requires that there be a translation, that it be substantially similar, then how do you determine substantially similar? And in this case, the registrant moved from one state to North Carolina, and he wanted to find out if he had to register. So he reported to the registration office, and I forget the name of the county, and they said, nope, you don't have to. Then he moved to another county. He moved to Wake County, which is Raleigh, and for whatever reason, unbeknownst to me, having been told by a registration official in the previous county, you don't have to register, but then he moved years later, he goes in again, which, you know, I don't know what inspired the going again, but he goes into Wake County and says, well, do I have to register? And they said, well, yeah, you do. So then he filed this action asking the court to declare that in order for them to do that, there has to be a process. The sheriffs themselves just can't make it up as they go. And that's what this case is about. So it will have far-reaching ramifications if the appellate review upholds the trial judge.
Do you think they'll appeal?
I'd be very surprised if North Carolina didn't appeal, because having due process costs money. And it's a lot easier to have the sheriff, when a person moves from Oklahoma to North Carolina, say, yeah, looks pretty much like a sex offense to me, by golly, and you'll have to register here. That's not very costly. Having a person move from Oklahoma to North Carolina and saying, well, we think you have to register here. Here's what we think it compares to, but you have the right to disagree with us, and you have 10 days to file an administrative appeal. And within 30 days, we'll schedule you a hearing before an administrative law judge, and you have the right to counsel, and you have the right to present evidence. That costs a little bit more than what the previous process I described. Now, which do you think, if you were the person who preserved the taxpayer resources in North Carolina, do you think you would want to have the second process or the first process? Which would be more cost efficient for the taxpayers of North Carolina?
Certainly the sheriff just making the determination.
Right. So that's why they would appeal. That would be one reason. Okay. The other reason would be because they can, and that drives people up the wall. But they theoretically, the North Carolina statute, according to the state attorney general's office, General Statute 14-208.6, subsection 4C, they say that they've done all the due process that he's entitled to, and they're going to continue to defend that and say that's our job as Attorney General. I put my hand on that Bible. I said I was going to defend the laws of the state, and that's what I'm going to do, and we're going to fight this tooth and nail, and I would be shocked if they didn't appeal. And this is a very new case. It was just decided November 7th, so it's only been out there for less.
All right, so let me try and interject my non-legal mind. We had the situation on Halloween where the sheriffs were then making people post signs where they had no statutory authority to do so.
Right.
Isn't this like very similar, that the sheriff doesn't have the statutory authority to make that determination?
No, this is not actually. The statute of North Carolina does say if it's substantially similar to another jurisdiction. They just didn't follow that up with establishing how that would be determined. And since the sheriff is the registering official, it appears though the sheriff has said, well, somebody's going to have to make a decision around here. I got to register them and I got to figure out, and I'm not going to be the one that tells them they don't have to register. That's not going to be good for my political career. So the sheriff is saying that since the statute requires that there be a substantially similar determination, and I'm the registering official, who the hell else do you think would make the decision? Of course I make the decision.
And the voters elected me. I've got that authority.
That's their position, and that's the attorney general's position, that there's a requirement. Now, the attorney general would likely, if he loses this on appeal, he would just urge the legislature of North Carolina to simply drop that there have to be a substantial similar determination. They could just simply cure this by saying anybody who's required to register anywhere is required to register here. Then you don't need all this kabuki stuff, due process, which is costly. There's another side of that argument that could be made. If I were trying to convince lawmakers you don't want that, I would say, well, you can do that, but there are states who have broader registration schemes, and we're going to be bringing in offenses here that probably aren't worthy of the resources that we're expending on tracking them. And then if I'm an enterprising lawyer, I'm going to argue an equal protection clause. I'm going to say, well, and another argument is that people who have come from out of state, they're not getting the same protection from North Carolina laws that they're entitled to, because we only register this list of offenses if you're convicted here, and then we register the whole broad universe of offenses from other states. So therefore, there's a new cause of action that can be possibly asserted. So, but that's one easy, quick fix, is to just eliminate that substantially similar test. And that's what I would expect them to do if they lose the litigation.
Which then goes back to your three legs of the stool of, if I remember right. So you have legislation, litigation, and education. So this is the legislation side, where we would then need to be in the state capitol watching for this language to be changed to somehow quell it from happening.
That is the if we were there, I can't guarantee you that we would be able to quell it. I will guarantee you this: if we're not there, we won't.
Yeah, I knew that's where you were going to go. So if you and I decide to, like, we're going to have some basketball tournament. And I'm pretty sure that both of us are going to be really sucky at basketball. But who wins if one of us doesn't show up?
That's the whole thing. And the registrant community, the registrant community doesn't understand that. There are no organizations. When I say no, that's not literal. There are very few organizations that are out there advocating our side. And if we're not organized, and if we're not there, and if we're not eloquent, articulate, and well-reasoned, they're going to win. They're paid to be there.
But they're going to win by default.
Well, they're going to win by default. Plus, they're paid to be there. They're professionals. They're the Association of Attorney Generals, Association of Prosecutors, the Sheriff's Association. All these people who wear nice insignia and nice three-piece suits, they're there telling the legislators how this is essential to keep the community safe. And when they look around the room and they say, does anyone have any concerns or opposition to this legislation? And there's dead silence. what do you expect the lawmakers to do in that setting? They need political cover. When they engage in their debate, they need political cover. And if the room is stone silent and all the other organizations have said this is essential for public safety, what do you expect them to do?
I also want to say that at the conference in Ohio, when the legislative panel was up there, somebody asked the question of, is there a scale? Like, you know, I don't know the right way to word this, but except for to give an example, you've been there 100 times, 1,000 times. You are polished and professional and you know what to do. I have never been. There has to be some sort of concession on their part. Like, look, this is a new person. We'll give them a lot of liberties, I guess, is kind of a way that I'm putting it. They're going to cut me a lot of slack, not to discount what I'm saying necessarily just because of it, but to just, like, you know, cut around the edges and figure out what I'm actually trying to do instead of just accepting that the person is there and grading me on the same scale as the professional, I guess, is the way that I should word that.
They are going to cut a citizen a lot of slack. They don't cut you a lot of slack if you come ill-informed. They cut you a lot of slack in terms of your stumbling and your speaking skills. But if you start spewing off stuff that that you don't know or cannot cite any source for, only victims' advocates get to be emotional. When you're in there on this cause, what you say needs to check out. You're not afforded the latitude to give untrue information. And I stress that to everybody. Certain people can. You can't. If you tell them recidivism is 3.2%, you better have a study to back it up if they ask for one. If you tell them the people on the registry for urinating in public, you better damn well have an example of that in your state, because that's one of the favorite lines. There's nobody on the registry that I know of for that offense. I never, ever say that because I can't back that up.
Fair.
And that's the kind of thing that'll bring you down if you're not credible. You don't have to be eloquent, but you have to be credible. And
if you start talking and you say that they're all corrupt and you know, it's a big kaboo, it's a kangaroo court, are they going to take that?
Yes.
Nicely?
If you start personally attacking them, you're not going to be very well received. Believe it or not, these people are good people. They're bad people mixed with good people, or within all professions. But these people, by and large, across the country, receive virtually no salaries. When you look at, in our state, they get a per diem, but in states they get $12,000, $14,000, $18,000, $22,000 a year. And it's a year-round job. Their phone calls coming in all the time from constituents, emails come in all the time, even when they're not in session. And there's neighborhood associations, there are people wanting this sponsored, that sponsored. You could make legislating a full-time job even though you don't get paid, if that's what you wanted to do. And they do this because they want to do good. Is there a small group that want to use it as a stepping stone to get to higher power? Of course there are, just like there are people who use anything for sinister purposes. But people who run for legislative offices, by and large, are good people. Even the ones I disagree with, they're good people. I think they're misguided, but they're good people. They believe firmly, as I do, in their position. They believe that if you cut taxes and balloon spending on the military, that somehow or another the deficit will go down. Of course, if you look at the history, it never does. But they believe that, or at least they convince me that they believe it. And I say, well, you know, I appreciate where you're coming from. I can't statistically bear you out. When we look at tax cuts, if we look at deficits, they always tend to balloon. But they believe a better example would probably be in people that believe in school vouchers. There are people who believe fervently that the difficulty in reforming public schools, with all the plethora of problems, there's no single problem with why the public schools are not doing well. They believe that rather than waiting for the reform to happen that's laboriously slow, that simply giving people a voucher for an equivalent amount of money that they can go out and spend of their own choosing is a solution. They believe that. I happen to believe that there are problems with that. But they're not evil people because they believe that. And you're going to find yourself in really bad straits in terms of how much credibility if you attack them because of their beliefs. You can challenge them on in terms of, I think this is misguided public policy, but there's a very fine line between not attacking a lawmaker personally And if you want to be successful, I advise you not to do it.
Well, coming back to this this case, let me try and come up with something of some halfway intelligent questions to ask. So this person was convicted of a sexual offense in another state, and he had either, did he get convicted before the registry had all taken place?
No, that's not the issue here. He was convicted in Washington, and it's merely an issue of the translation. He was convicted of a misdemeanor offense in 2004, communication of minor for immoral purposes. And the question is, does that translate to one of the crimes on the list in North Carolina? North Carolina doesn't have a catch-all that says, if you're required to register anywhere, you're required to register here. They have language that says it has to be substantially similar. And the sheriff in the first county said it's not. And then years later, when he moved, he was first in, it says, and they're spelling it P-E-R-S-O-N. I'm assuming that's the sheriff's office in Person County, which I've never heard of Person, but let's assume that I've got it correct. He registered. He went in there in 2004 and said, do I have to register for this communication minor for moral purposes? Sheriff said, no, don't reckon so. Don't think that looks like anything compared to anything we register here. And then 5 years later, he moved to Wake County, which is Raleigh, and he goes back and visits them again in Wake County. And it's not clear to me why, if you've been told by a governmental official you don't have to register, I don't know why you'd go into a new sheriff's office, but he
that's
did.
Why, well, that's what I was going to ask you. That's what I wanted to ask you. So if he had been in North Carolina and had been told once to not register, why would he then go back into the belly of the beast and try and figure out if he had to register a second time around?
It gets even funnier. In 2009, when he first went to Wake office, the sheriff's office, they told him he didn't have to register. It wasn't until 2017. So remember, he's been in North Carolina since 2004. So it wasn't until 2017 that the Wake County sheriff changed their mind. The deputy then said, my golly, I'm taking a look at this thing. It sure looks substantially similar to a reportable conviction to me. So
he went into the sheriff's office a third time?
They apparently contacted him in 2013. So
how did he come up on their radar then, I wonder?
Well, I think it'd be very easy to contact. If you got a driver's license, they just go run your driver's license and go out and see where you're living.
Not how to figure out where he is, but why did he come up on their radar of someone's just that bored looking for they don't have enough people on the registry in North Carolina already.
That they audited through a list of people. A new sheriff possibly got elected and said, we need to go through the people that we've told that don't have to, are not required to register, and let's take another look at them. We may have gotten it wrong. And they could have taken a more critical look at that communication. Which, in my view, I think it very well could be substantially similar. I've done my own analysis, and I think that. But the issue is not whether he has to register. The issue is due process. The issue is that they don't have the process. Once they put the process in place, assuming they lose this appeal, if they win this appeal, they don't have to do it in due process. But once they put the process in place, then they can go back and decide it is substantially similar, and he'll be right back where he is now. He has to register.
Which is to say, my hot button is the polygraph. Your hot button is due process.
My hot button is very much due process, and I'm fearful that we're losing it in America. And this thing, since the complexity of registration is so it's vastly different. The states that have this language, which is fairly common, they have the equivalent, substantial equivalent, substantially similar. They have language all over the map like this. And some states do have to catch all that if you have to register anywhere. But if they choose to say, we register you if you have a substantially or an equivalent offense, then you've got to provide a process that's somewhat objective and fair to determine if that offense is similar. And you've got to give the person a right to an appeal and to present evidence why it's not substantially similar or equivalent. That's all this battle is about. And North Carolina will probably decide it's too complicated, and they'll just say, we'll take that language out and just say, if you register anywhere, you have to register here.
Which then goes back to having someone watching the legislative process to try and interject our best methods into it as best we could, but we generally don't have representation.
Not adequate, and generally many times none, but this case is not binding, but it's certainly persuasive because it's a well-written opinion. We could link, I guess, to it on the show notes. It's a well-written decision.
Yeah.
Those states that have that language, if you think that your offense may not be registrable, number one, or you think that under that the new state you're in, if you believe that it should be translated to a lower level of registration, then this case could be beneficial to you. Because if they're telling you, well, by golly, this is a tier three lifetime, and if you legitimately can say, and you don't go back to the state where you said, well, it's a tier one in my state of conviction, that's not relevant. What's relevant is if you translate that offense as close as you can to the new state's scheme and what it translates to. If it's only a tier one or tier two, and they're telling you it's a tier three, this is an important thing to you because the due process has not been provided you for you to challenge their determination that it's a tier three or maybe a tier two when it should be a tier one. This case could make a significant difference.
Now I understand.
It could make a significant difference, but don't focus on your state of conviction. We no longer care about that state. If you want that state's rules, go live there.
I understand. So if you get convicted of something like, let's just say you urinated in public and some state, whatever, they don't even care, but it's a registrable offense, but it's a level one and there are no obligations behind that. But you move to North Carolina that says urinating in public is a tier three offense and you have like lifetime monitoring. That's why this matters. It doesn't matter what they were talking about in Wyoming or wherever it was where you urinated in front of a buffalo and you got put on the registry for that. Well, go to North Carolina.
In this case, he's just arguing that it's not even registrable, period.
I get that. Yeah.
But the other component of this that makes it significant is that you may have a claim that the new state has improperly categorized you, even though your offense is covered. And most of the state's registry schemes are broad enough to cover the basic universe of sex offenses. It's the nuanced sex offenses where you're going to come into a problem. So it's not going to be so much it's going to keep you from having to register, but it may keep you from having a longer obligation if they correctly tier you. And that's why this is important.
I was going to ask you the question of why does this matter to anybody else? But that's why, like you said, it doesn't matter the state that you came from. And I'm using stupid, ridiculous arguments or examples to try and, I mean, you know, which, you know, if you have a CM charge, you're going to end up being registered, but maybe where you came from, it is a 5-year obligation, but where you're going, it's a 10-year obligation. And the nuance there of age differences, or was it above the clothes, under the clothes, whatever, all those things could then come into play to give you more or less registrable time.
That is correct. And the states where it's everyone's lifetime, then the only question for you then is, does your offense translate to a registrable offense in that state if that is the language that they require that it be equivalent or similar to? But if they have varying levels of durations of registration, then it's much more important how this translation is done. In California, right now, everybody's still lifetime. Texas, everybody's lifetime. Florida, everybody's lifetime. Doesn't matter if you go into one of those states, because if you're covered, then you're going to register for life. We don't care about the other state's requirements. But where there are varying amounts of terms of registration, this is extremely important. And I'm looking forward to litigating this in my state. I'm gearing up and looking for people right now who have out-of-state convictions that would make favorable plaintiffs to do this, because I want to establish once and for all, since we do have the language similar to what North Carolina has, that there has to be a due process and it can't be just the secretary that answers the telephone at the Department of Public Safety in Santa Fe. And that's not who it is. It's another person I shall not name at the moment. But I don't want that person making the decision with no due process. I want us to have a bona fide process to determine what the out-of-state conviction is equivalent to under our law.
I understand. And I mean, so you're not even necessarily trying to derail this so that it doesn't happen at all, just that there's some process that helps you have representation and get a fair shake out of it.
Right. I want there to be a 10-year register here is vastly different than a 20-year or lifetime. You can't join the 20-year group because that's based on when you were, if you were off paper, if you had finished your obligations prior to on or before June 30, 2005, then you have a fixed 20-year period or a fixed 10-year period. Anybody, you can't join that. It's hard to get off paper now prior to June 30, 2005. But it's important if you're a 10-year offender, if your offense translates to a 10-year versus a lifetime, because if you're a 10-year offender, then You don't get internet publication, and you only have to report once a year unless you were convicted after July 1, 2013, which is twice a year, and 10 years it ends. If the Department of Public Safety says you're a lifetime, then it translates to a lifetime offense without any due process, then you have no hope of getting off. That's why it's important.
Right.
And I suspect most people would prefer 10 years versus life.
Do you – so Laura's in the chat, and she asks if she thought you went by the laws in your state so people can't state shop. What does this do for that type of mindset?
Well, when she says by the laws in your state, I'm assuming she means your state of conviction, and that's not correct.
Correct. Right. Okay.
That is not correct. It is registration is governed by the state that you're living in. Now, that state, by its prerogative, can determine that they go by the other state. Utah does that. Utah says you'll register for at least 10 years or the period required in your state of conviction. But Utah is an anomaly. In doing that. The majority of the states don't do it that way. So your state that you're convicted in has nothing to do with your registration term if you leave that state.
And this isn't related to supervision. This is post-supervision, right?
Yeah, we're not talking about supervision. She needs to get that out of here. On supervision, that is driven by the state where you're convicted. Supervision is not registration. You may register while you're supervised, but they're not the same thing.
Right.
And your supervision, if Georgia says you've got 10 years of probation and you go to Vermont, you've got 10 years of probation unless Georgia says otherwise. And you've got Georgia's conditions of probation plus whatever Vermont puts on you that they're allowed to do under the interstate compact. They can add conditions that are consistent with how they supervise a similarly convicted offender there. Only Georgia can release you. Vermont can communicate to Georgia that you're doing fine and that supervision can either be relaxed. They could recommend that Georgia no longer require in-person supervision. And they can do a number of things. But Georgia is the only entity that can release you from supervision.
And so this case isn't about supervision. This is post-supervision, just dealing with the registry side of it.
Only dealing with registration.
And that only then deals with the state that you're in. And we're not talking about sending and receiving states. It's just where you is be.
That's
where your feet are present, where you call home at the moment.
Where you have an obligation to register. And this guy went from Washington, where he had communicated with a minor for immoral purposes, to North Carolina. And he's now under North Carolina law. If he wants to be under Washington law, he's free to go back there.
Or pick another country if he so chooses.
So I see another one popped up. What does that one say? My glasses are off.
Oh no, we're just completing the thought. She just says, "I see where my confusion was."
So I'm glad I could help. That'll be $25, please.
Absolutely. Well, she's already a Patreon supporter.
So. I'm just kidding.
I know. And thank you for that. And thank you all patrons. I actually didn't even bring that up at the beginning of the show.
Oh, we'll get to it.
Yeah. I mean, this is in one respect. I mean, it's not there. We're looking for a silver bullet, which isn't going to happen. But this is something that is positive for you because you could be in a state that says we just register you if you have a sexual offense. And so you could be convicted of wearing two different colored clothing and they call that a sexual offense. And now you're on the registry in that other state. So this helps you end up having a more fair process. That's why this is good news for us and why we need to support what goes down with this.
Absolutely. And it's going to be the launch pad for more litigation in this area because I'm already pitching it based on this well-written district judge. And this is according to our North Carolina people, this is a fairly conservative district judge. This is not a bleeding heart do-gooder. So this makes it me more likely that it will be upheld on appeal. But I do expect an appeal. And I'm hoping that it is upheld, and then it's precedential within that circuit, and it has more power outside the circuit because we can say, well, the Fourth Circuit said in this case that there must be due process for out-of-state translation of sexual offenses, and this is just good stuff.
Interesting. Still a lot for me to digest. I guess it would be something that we will come back around and touch on as it develops further.
We will probably invite Paul to come talk about it. He's a little hesitant now because he wants to digest and hopes they don't appeal. And I said, well, Paul, it'd be so unlikely they wouldn't appeal. But he doesn't want to be fanning any flames or giving anybody any. Well, if you haven't gone on the podcast and been running your mouth, we wouldn't have appealed. So he's going to keep a low profile. But I would say after the period for notice of appeal expires, then we can have him on the podcast. And that's coming up real soon.
Okay. Sounds good. It is like we're coming up on holiday season. I have a lot of travel plans. I have no idea what's going to happen with the next episode. So stay tuned. It may happen. It may not. I can't be so sure. And well,
I think we should record another one right away before you travel.
That is very, very possible. It is very possible. But I will have gear with me. We could record remotely. I just don't know what my schedule is. Got to go visit the people that pay me.
Uh-huh. Well,
I'm not referring to the Patreon people.
and how do we grow the podcast audience?
Absolutely. Be like William and go onto every article that you find out there on the internet and reference back to this podcast and tell the people that they need to start listening to this. Hey, I did start doing, I don't know if I should announce this to everybody. I did start doing Google ads. So as people are typing in keywords related to registry issues, they should end up with a Google advertisement popping up in their face.
Oh, that's going to cause you to get shot.
That is very possible. We could end up with some enemies here on the podcast at some point in time. Yeah, but so here's what you do. You go to the website, which is registrymatters.co. And don't ask me why I didn't register .com, but it is a .co. No M at the end. It's just .co. And we always like to hear voicemail messages. As you have figured out by now, I'm sure we will play them, most of them anyway, and try and keep them short. But the phone number for that is 747-227-4477. I don't answer that phone very often. It just goes straight to voicemail. That's, just record it there. It's great. If you want to shoot us an email message directly, you can do that at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, we appreciate the supporters of the podcast. Thank you so very much. It is very humbling, and I'm privileged that we are able to receive those funds from people. And that is patreon.com/registrymatters. If you would like to join in, you could, if you do get onto Patreon, then you'll automatically get on the Discord server. But if you want, shoot me a message and you could listen to the show recorded live or ask questions while we're covering it, which would also be kind of fun because then get a little outside influence and participation in asking Larry questions instead of me trying to go, what? I don't know what you're talking about, man.
We're going to have a guest, one of our conservative leaning listeners, sent an email, and we have reached out to him, and we're going to have him in the coming weeks for sure for one episode and possibly more. We're going to try to put balance in this podcast.
Outstanding. Oh, wow. So it's going to be Hannity and Combs.
Well, to the extent we can make it work. And, but I'm looking forward to trying that because I love intellectual discussion with informed people, and I'm looking forward to having some discussion with the other side.
Well, I hope I provide you with some level of intellectual conversation.
You do indeed. To me, this is a positive experience because, like, just even we just helped someone that was struggling with understanding the difference between registration and supervision. One of our prominent leaders, not that many years ago, had the same struggle. And it's common for people to confuse the two. The state controls your supervision, your sentence that imposed it, and the state you're living in controls your registration requirements unless they decided to give that power to the state where you're convicted. But by and large, that doesn't happen right that way.
Interesting. Well, as always, Larry, I appreciate your time and insight, and we will talk soon. And I hope you have a great night.
Thanks, Andy. Good night.